to No Filter Sports. It is July 20th, 2020. A lot of 20s in there. Eli Zarrett, Bob Page, and Denny McClain. And boys, here we go. In the midst of a pandemic that has the world in a state of utter panic and shock and disbelief, baseball returns. And I must remind you, in 29 of the 30 cities. And that is because the Blue Jays... will not allow they can the Blue Jays can play there. The problem is the Jays can't play with anybody else. It's a
they waited to the 11th hour on that. The Canadian government didn't know. We don't want any
makes no sense, does it? I mean, what a silly thing not to let them play.
Well, no, they're going to play. They just have to find a new place outside.
No, Canada. I know that, but I mean, they do have a beautiful ballpark.
Well, they do, but the Canadian infection rates for COVID-19 are so dramatically low compared to the U.S. Yeah. I don't know why they waited so long, but fellas, think about this. While the Blue Jays, at least as we record this on Monday morning, are looking for a place to play, what the hell difference does it make? There's no home field advantage that anybody's going to have because there ain't going to be no fans anywhere.
But that means that they don't get to be at home at all. They're on the road for the entire season. They're not allowed to play games there, which is a polite way.
If they play in Buffalo, which they're really thinking about doing, that's not
probably
is Buffalo Toronto? No, Buffalo is
close.
Not Toronto.
It's very close. Okay, only 150. Yeah. Okay. It's only 150 miles.
It's like saying that the Tigers can play in Columbus. It's the same as playing in Columbus. It's home. It's a polite way the Canadian government is saying is that we have done a crappy job of containing the coronavirus. I don't blame them at all. He says, what did the minister say? They require to play in locations where the risk of transmission remains high. Locations, singular. The USA, one big location. Is the problem is why no one can play in Toronto this year. It's very, very sad. But anyway.
Well, you know the other thing, too, Buffalo's a nice little ballpark for AAA, but it's not a major league park. And
doesn't matter. Nobody going anyway.
That's right. As long as
I understand that. Okay. But the players, never mind. I won't try. What I'm trying to say is it's not major league anything. It's not dimensions. It's not clubhouse. It's not anything. I go up there a lot. And it's just a little bit different up there. People who live in Buffalo, by the way, are a little different. Nice people, but
it goes to show how this everything is in a terrible state of flux.
Well,
three leagues are all.
Danny, I want to add one thing about what you just said before Eli goes off here. I ran into at Madison Square Garden years ago, Jim Schoenfeld, the great defenseman, with your beloved Chicago Blackhawks.
Eat another donut.
In Buffalo. Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, when he was coach. Right. So I said to him, I said, Shoney, where are you living now? He could live anywhere he wanted to. He says, no, I'm still back in Buffalo. I said, Buffalo? You're still living in Buffalo? Why? He says one thing, greatest people in the world.
Yeah. Hmm.
And that's what everybody says about Buffalo, New York.
And Buffalo reminds me a lot of Detroit. I mean, hard-working guys. They go to work every day.
Great
snow,
people.
Sleet doesn't make any
cold,
difference.
Northern, I mean, they're industrial super city. So the Tigers begin on Friday at the Reds for 3 with a home opener next Monday, week from today, the 27th. But what's going on with this league? They play the Reds for 3. Then 2 more here with the Reds, then 2 at St. Louis, 3 in Pittsburgh, 10 of the first 14 with National League teams.
So now you're bitching about the schedule with everything else we got to worry
about.
What
league are we in? I don't even know anymore. The only teams in our league that they will play are the usual suspects, the White Sox, the Indians, the Twins, and Royals, as if we're not tired enough of seeing those teams over and over again. No Yankees, no Red Sox, no Angels. And by the way, from the opener in Cincinnati this Friday, the 24th, they will play 38 games in 39 days from July 24th to August 30th. Yes, that is the 60-game sprint, as Michael's.
Yeah, and speaking of the Red Sox and the Tigers, did you mention, did I miss it somehow, our guest on the program today?
Oh, no, our guest on the program today will be the great general manager of the Detroit Tigers, Dave Dombrowski,
who took this
moribund franchise. They had won, he came here in 2002. They had lost 95 games the year before. They lost 109 a few years before that. Remember there was talk at the time that Detroit has lost an entire generation of fans, including young Brandon McAfee, who by the mid-90s was 10 years old and proceeded for the next 14 years to see garbage after garbage after garbage. But Brandon, tell us, when you were growing up, when you were a teenager and the Tigers sucked year in, year out, were you a fan then, or did it only happen later when they got good?
I think that was the time when hockey really took over Detroit. You know, we had that monster stretch where we had successful Stanley Cup runs, and I think that kind of eclipsed the Tigers for a bit. And even though I did really get back into baseball with the home run chases of 1998, it was a bummer not being able to have that team, that Detroit Tigers team that was being successful. And to tell you the truth, I mean, the occasional game I would watch, the occasional game I would go to just to have a good time at Comerica Park, but... You're right. It wasn't until 04 and everything blew up in 06 and all of a sudden, boom, everybody's back into the Tigers, and it was a great 10-year run.
That's interesting because when I was a boy growing up in Detroit, there were no television of the Detroit Red Wings. No television. The only time you had a chance to see them, and I watched every Saturday night in the winter, was on Hockey Night in Canada out of Windsor on Channel 9 because the Wings would play at Toronto against the Leafs sometime. We grew up in what is now known as the Golden Era of baseball, and I'm happy we did when baseball was everything to us.
And Bob, why wasn't our hockey team on TV?
Well, one of the problems they had, Denny, was that there weren't a lot of TV stations.
Well, that's not the reason. The reason is there would be no viewership. It'd be very minimal viewership.
In Detroit.
And I'm not going to go along on this.
In Detroit?
Because I know,
Detroit?
In Detroit. You're absolutely right, in Detroit.
You don't know. You're wrong.
Yes, I do. I mean,
ridiculous.
All you got to do is take a look at the attendance attendance when they're playing relatively well and not playing relatively well, and you'll see a dramatic difference in attendance.
Right. Well, you were just a kid with the Tigers in 1965, and I was a huge fan when WKBD Channel 50 in Detroit won a year. And most people don't know this, as the nation's first all sports station. So they had to fill programming. What did they do? They started televising all the Wings games and all the
Channel
Michigan 50? Basketball home games.
Channel 50 was all sports back then?
Yeah. Channel 51
really?
On the air is an all sports station.
Jeez,
and at least Tiger games were on TV. But man, and it was hard to get a ticket for a Wings game when I was a boy growing up. You know,
well, they were winning.
Can I interject for 1 minute? And please bear with me here. It'll only take a short period of time, maybe a minute. But you're talking about television. And now we got baseball and hockey and maybe football and certainly basketball with no fans at all. Let me just remind you what an incredible turnaround this is, that no spectators anticipate, at least till football season. Even so, there was a time when all the revenue from sports came from people attending games. Back in the old days, no TV, no radio, just buy a ticket or read about it in tomorrow's paper. Now it is the opposite, the exact opposite. Tiger Woods walks the fairways alone. LeBron James will dribble in spectatorless bubble. MLB begins with this week with empty, echoey ballparks. So fans and athletes should remember this. And here's what I'm trying to say. The skill of athletes has absolutely zero value if people don't see it. Without spectators, an athlete's skill, service to the world is worth less than that of a garbage man, a cashier, or an Uber driver. Zero. The entire value, otherwise it's a hobby, is based on people seeing you. And now no one can go to a ballpark and see
you. I've been trying to tell you this for how long? You said, oh, no, you got to watch. I did watch baseball over the weekend. Did you guys watch any baseball?
No, I didn't. I didn't.
Oh, I did. And here's what I watched on ESPN. I watched the Mets and the Yankees play at you know, Citi Field. And the high temperature, as we speak in New York today, is going to be 95, like Detroit. They're in the midst of a horrendous heat wave right there. And I saw the managers and the coaches in that kind of heat wearing masks in the dugout. Is Aaron Boone really that afraid? So they put in a little crowd noise. And the little buzz, believe it or not, once you forgot it was fake, helped out a little bit. They did have fan cutouts in the stands behind home plate. Okay. And then behind home plate, they had a pavilion set up. The pavilion for any player who was so afraid they didn't want to stay in the dugout. And they had signs on the backs of seats. Sit here. So you could sit there in the next seat where a player could sit when he wasn't in the game. It was like, whatever, 6, 8, 10 feet away. Sit here. I mean, this was the scariest thing. The only thing that made it palatable, two things. Number one is the obviously unbelievable skill of the players. They're just incredible to watch. But the Mets broadcast team, the best by far in all of baseball, they were entertaining. They made it funny. And you listen to Gary Cohen, Nobody going to muzzle him or Keith Hernandez or Ron Darling. Now, Gary Cohen wasn't sucking up and saying, oh, what a great atmosphere this is. Isn't this terrific? He said Jacob DeGrom will not pitch against the Yankees tomorrow. He laughed and said he's going to throw a simulated game. What the hell was I watching to begin with? And then he said, watching this is almost like watching a Gulf Coast League game in Florida. Because there's nobody there.
Yeah. You know, I just.
Well, wait a second. I've been sitting here about 10 minutes waiting to get one word in. I'll underscore what you said and support it in one sense. Because I was there when Jim Campbell, we had a doubleheader going on when the riots broke out in 67. And Campbell, the chief of police, came up to Campbell up in the box. You know how that box was he had along the first baseline, and said, listen, I want to shut down the games. I want to get rid of the people. I want them all out of here. And Campbell said, I have 53,000 people who paid to get in here today. You will not touch this ballpark today. And guess what? The chief left. They left a lot of cops, too. But that's how important that gate was every day that we played.
Good point. I just want to say my whole point here is that fans, and particularly athletes, ought to realize how lucky they are to be into this, and that they should respect the fact that without people watching them, they are useless. I'll tell you a little story. Okay. I was talking to Ben Gordon of the Pistons about 10 years ago. He had just signed a new 5-year, $55 million free agent contract. I said, Ben, take away the screaming PA announcer, the pyrotechnics, the dancers, the ones in the skimpy outfits with the heavy makeup that shoot t-shirts in the upper deck, put you and the rest of tonight's starters in a playground in Detroit playing skins and shirt, and nobody will notice you at all. And yet you put on the fancy shorts with the shirt and the logo, and voila, people pay $1,000 to sit near you. With no fans, I think players ought to look in the mirror and say, man, we are lucky. Otherwise, hitting the baseball is a hobby, and I got to go make a real living.
Yeah. It's just so tough. And Eli, here's another thing that the Mets broadcasters brought up last night. This panic and this paranoia is so unbelievable. They said that once an umpire puts a ball out of play, they take all of those baseballs, they put them, after they disinfect those baseballs, they put them in a bag, and they cannot use them for 5 days. They're going to wait to make sure the baseballs are no longer infected with COVID-19.
This is insanity. No, it isn't insanity. It is not insanity.
It is not insanity.
The fact is, people are dying at a higher rate in this country than they were back in the beginning.
Okay.
More people are getting it. Kids are getting it. Parents are getting it. They're going to talk about starting school.
Okay.
Kids
are going to get their parents sick. I want to say this.
I'm going to tell you, man, we have screwed this up from day one.
All right,
fine. We're behind the other country.
I'm going to give you one stat from El Paso, Texas. 33% of the people who are now getting the virus are between the ages of 11 and 30.
Yeah, that's okay.
Think about that.
They'll be all right.
Few will die.
Here's
the thing. When an 8-year-old comes home from first grade or second or third grade, and he's infected, he infects his parents, his grandparents, his neighbors, and that's the problem with all of this. We've been against the masks.
Yeah,
we've done it wrong. We should be too bad. We can't go back to the beginning.
Right. Okay,
start all over again. I just
want to make one quick point.
Your point.
Obviously, you did not see this. There was a very interesting article in the Wall Street Journal just a couple days ago. The journal quoted all kinds of medical experts and saying, we're now beginning to understand how we get COVID-19. It is not from touching a countertop. It is not from touching baseballs like that. It's from direct and sometimes prolonged contact with another human being who is positive for COVID.
And you pass it by droplets that come from your mouth, wear a goddamn mask.
But not by touching baseballs.
Okay. Okay.
But Bob, listen, they're going to every extreme they can to make sure that the general, let me tell you what's going to happen. People are coming into the ballpark, whether they sign a mandate or not, and give the ball club permission not to, they can't sue anybody, of course, they're probably going to have them sign this document. Guess what? That document has got about as much wealth as a pencil laying here on the floor. I mean, because it's got no standing. So you're going to have lawsuits that come out of this because the Tigers didn't clean up the ballpark well enough. You know that's going to happen.
Maybe. Did you see this video of Clint Frazier? You're familiar with him, I think, the Yankees outfielder.
Sure.
He hit a home run the other day in one of these practice games wearing a face mask.
Mm-hmm.
So the deal is that this is one of the few major leaguers this year who intends to wear a face mask all the time. And again, it's 95 degrees in New York today, and it's going to be pretty miserable wearing that face mask all the time. I guess this kid's afraid that if a ball comes hurtling to the plate, COVID-19 germs are going to go in his nostril, and he's going to be dead within 10 days.
Don't make fun of it, please.
Why not?
Please,
in that case,
don't make fun of it.
38,000
people
dead.
Don't be smarmy making fun of this crap, okay? Don't. Just don't.
You just called it crap.
Now, by the same token, fake crowd noise that you mentioned is probably a decent idea. They're going to try that. And I tell you, if they mic up players and create more intimacy with the game, I'm for that. They have a chance to make certain things better. And I'll tell you, I'm watching golf, and I watched the tournament yesterday. I watched all the Memorial. And as a golf junkie or whatever you want to call it, or wacko, whatever term you give it, they're all valid. I love it more than I did with crowd, with people, because I can hear that they're playing the game just like we do, but better. They compliment each other on good shots. That the talk is the same, but it's at a level that you can really appreciate, because they're so much better than all the millions of us that go out there and play the game.
To
be able to hear it and be intimate with it and hear the conversations of what they're trying to do is fascinating. I love it. So hopefully baseball and basketball and whatever else will have some modern broadcast techniques and technology to make the game a little more interesting than it may have with otherwise, minus, of course, all the things we're going to miss, like, you know,
I'm not a golf wacko, as you know, but I do watch the PGA Tour all the time, or at least I did, past tense. And of course, I watched some of the Memorial Tournament over the weekend. I couldn't get into it. It is so strange to see a guy make a great shot, and there's just no reaction anywhere.
You're absolutely right.
Isn't watching the great shot enough? Isn't watching the great shot enough?
Not for me.
The one great shot that I saw yesterday was the chip in from off the green in heavy grass. How he made the shot, because that ball can go 45 different ways from where he was, and he hit it perfectly and knocked it right in. I couldn't believe it. I said, my God, Jesus has returned to the green.
Well, there's the skill level is
unbelievable.
It'd be great to hear the crowd and all that, but my only point is other elements can be used, and I hope they do, to at least make it worth watching.
Okay, can I say something else about the Memorial? I know we got to go to a break
Go ahead.
But the noted and the great broadcast journalist, what's her name? Amanda Baliones, interviewed Tiger after he had finished his round yesterday with a 76 in his final round. And we'll get to this. Denny McClain's been saying for some time, and he's right, Tiger should have retired if he's not going to play. So Amanda says to Tiger, she says, well, when are you going to play again? Tiger looks at her and just says, soon. How about a follow-up question? Tiger, what are you doing? You want to get back to form or not? How are you going to do it playing like this? He doesn't even know when he's going to play yet.
He's half the man he used to be. His back was acting up. It's amazing he can play.
Why play? Your back's acting up. Why play? Why besmirch your memory as arguably the greatest player who ever lived?
I don't think he'll be besmirched the memories of the greatness that he once possessed. I mean, he was the greatest golfer I've ever seen in my life. I've seen them all.
Oh, by the way,
I got to tell you something. The things that he did with a golf ball would have outshined everybody in this current state. Of course, we can't do that. But the bottom line with Tiger right now, he's sloppy when he gets over the ball. He's never looks like he's ready. He's slow with his swing. His backswing is not going anywhere anymore. And he's not hitting fairways. Man, when you don't hit fairways, you got a long, long four
days.
It's
embarrassing, isn't it, Denny?
I don't know about embarrassing because, you know, he's such a great player. Every once in a while, he hit a great shot. I mean, that's what you're sitting there watching him play for.
You can't take your eyes off him when he plays. He won the FedEx Cup 2 years ago, 2018. He won the Masters last year. What he's doing at his age, in his physical condition, is a marvel. And people love to see him. And this is, Bob, you do what so many fans do. Oh, you either should retire or you shouldn't retire. Why is Barry retiring so early? Why doesn't he retire? Why is he making another comeback? We always want to put our own likes and dislikes onto what people should do with their lives and careers. The fact that he's playing is playing in pain. He's the greatest of all time. And I don't think we should judge whether he plays enough Too much, not at all, whatever.
He's not so hurting, not hurting so badly that he can't go out and try to get his game a little bit tighter. I think he can get his game a whole lot tighter than what he is and at least be in the top 10 all the time.
We said this a few years ago. Why bother to come back? He comes back. So now it'll be like Bob is saying, why go on? Why play? In a year or so, he'll be feeling better. He'll win another tournament. Right. Oh, he's back again,
yeah.
And we'll be glad that he didn't retire. Hey, want to welcome some of our new sponsors. It's been a while now, but maybe about a month or so. We're so happy that Feldman Automotive is with us. It's the number one Chevy dealer in Michigan. It's got five locations in Novi, New Hudson, Lansing, Livonia, and Highland, and four other locations, including 1-800 Pre-Owned Supercenter located in Waterford, the number one place to get a pre-owned car in the Midwest. There's Feldman Hyundai in New Hudson, Feldman Key of Novi, and Feldman in Woodhaven. There's a Feldman dealership and a used or certified pre-owned vehicle near you. Support our sponsors. They believe in us, and we hope that you will go see them when you need a car. Certainly, out of nine locations, you can find a car for you at Feldman. Guaranteed credit approval, hassle-free. You can buy it at home on FeldmanAuto.com or in the showroom. Also encourage you to look into Power Home Solar, based right here in Metro Detroit, America's fastest-growing solar energy company. All their state-of-the-art solar panels made in America. Save money, help save the environment, help yourself avoid power outages, because Power Home Solar is now partnering with Generac, the nation's largest provider of in-home backup battery and generator systems. You will suffer no more outages either in the dead of winter or the heat of summer when the systems go down or when the wires go down or the power goes down. Lower your energy bills and eliminate power outages forever. So support our guys so they'll continue to support us. Call Power Home Solar at 1-800-POWER-90. Save an additional $1,800, and financing starts at $99 a month. You're listening to the No Filter Sports Podcast.
I got a couple of positive baseball stories, and there is a lot of baseball stories. A lot of going on in baseball. Yeah. First of all, I saw a picture in the newspapers, I'm sure you guys did too, of Michael Fulmer. God, he looks so much thinner. Yeah, now, if he's really back in form, and he claims that he is, if he joins Matthew Boyd and some of these impressive-looking kid pitchers like Casey Mize, Tigers might do very well. And now with Jordan Zimmerman, you don't want to ever see anybody hurt. But this is another big positive. He's on the 45-day DL, and it looks like his career with the Tigers is over now. Zimmer will never pitch for them again. Denny's been saying all along, and he's so right about this, he wants to see Casey Mize. Guess what, Denny? You're going to see him now.
I hope so. They got to let the kid pitch a little bit, get used to it, just feel the environment, understand what the environment's all about. And unfortunately, he won't have, unless they let fans in before the end of the year, like football is still planning on doing, I guess. But that's what he needs. He needs the people screaming and hollering, good and bad hollering and whatever. But you know what? If he is the kid everybody says he is, we're in for a lot of good stuff in the next 5 or 10 years.
Watch. Yeah, I wouldn't see Salen seeing him right away, because if they bring him up from the beginning, they got to give him a year's credit. So he's going to probably miss him the first month or the first couple of weeks. That way they can hold off his free agency by a year. I think it would be to 2027.
Well, that's an interesting point. Yeah, that's I hope they don't do that.
Right. But, you know,
interesting point. And now if we had good news in baseball right there, how about some really bad news in baseball? A listener emailed us on Sunday that fellow Detroit native Rick Reed had died at the age of 70. I knew Rick so well. Longtime American League umpire. He's in that movie with Kevin Costner. So USA Today gave him a big write-up. Rick worked 13 years in the minors before telling his great wife, Cindy, to please give it one more season. He borrowed money just to pay their bills, and he finally made it. Wonderful guy, family man, never left Detroit. His dad was a Detroit City police officer, and it was so shocking. And how about this, fellas? Tony Taylor's death
was
announced shortly after we recorded the show on Thursday.
This is terrible.
Tiger fans remember him from the 72 AL East title team. Not just a popular player, but I've said this before, but I stayed in a hotel with the 62 Phillies as a boy in San Francisco. I will never forget how nice Tony Taylor was to me, signing autographs, talking to me. It was such a thrill, and I had a chance to meet Tony for the first time at one of those Joe DiMaggio All-Star games in Florida a few years ago. Thanked him personally for being such a great guy.
Tony
Taylor's gone.
By the way, on this day in history, which we'll get to later, Jim Bunning pitched a perfect game for the Tigers on this day back in 1958. But in 1964, I was at the game at Shea Stadium. It was the second year it opened. And he pitched a perfect game in game two of the doubleheader. And Tony Taylor saved it with a diving catch at second base. Now, before we go here, you had mentioned Jordan Zimmerman. And perhaps the worst free agent signing in Tigers history, I would say. I was trying to think of others where for $110 million, he was 25-41 with a 5.61 ERA, 1.2 WAR over all those years for all that money. It's really one of the saddest things in last year. I mean, how do you go 1-13 no matter how bad the team is with a 6.91 ERA? So I tried to look up what are some other awful free agent pitcher signings. And the worst I come up with was when the Giants signed Barry Zito. But even so, Zito won some games for them, even though, you know, it was an awful contract and he struggled. But man, what Zimmerman did for that 5 years is just one of the saddest episodes in Tiger history.
Yeah. When Avila signed him, he was coming off a 13-12 season.
Yeah.
All that money.
Right, he had started to decline 2014 and 2015, but nobody would have thought that the deal would turn into that big.
But he had a lot. Give him, you know, one thing. He had a lot of injuries. He had a lot of problems.
Yeah. Yep.
You know, so there's not much you can do at that level of professional sports if you don't have all your health, at least 100% of your health. I mean, it's a tough game, and the intensity is beyond belief.
And Danny, you've pointed out, I don't know if you know him, I've never met him, but you've pointed out several times that Zimmerman is supposed to be just this great guy. You know, he's from Wisconsin. You'd never wish ill on anybody like that. It just didn't work out.
Now, you mentioned
And the other guy, Zito, I saw him pitch. And I got to tell you something. The guy had the greatest curveball I ever saw in my life. He could get that curveball over all the time. The problem is he couldn't get his fastball over, and he had a good one. But the only problem is, of course, it failed to find the little white thing in the middle of the plate. So, if he could have ever got his stuff, I think he won 21 year. But
before
I'm
going
to tell you, when he got those two pitches over, he was better than anybody I ever saw.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm actually looking at him right now on the Wikipedia.com.
Yeah.
And yeah, you're right, man. Impressive talent, impressive stats. I mean, you know, you just don't know. The human arm, Denny. It's a fragile thing, but I guess you don't need me to tell you that.
The next pitch is it. And Zito had the kind of stuff that nobody could touch if he was throwing strikes. All he needed was two pitches, his curveball and his fastball. Koufax had a monster curveball. This curveball with Zito was better, believe it or not.
You mentioned Michael Fulmer before we put the baseball and the Tigers away. He said, it's a 60-game sprint. Teams come out of the chute hot, and it's any team's prize to take home. It's whoever starts the best. We believe 100% we can make the playoffs and ultimately win the whole thing because we feel good about where our team is at. Ugh.
CJ Kwan is supposed to be looking really good, the free agent signee from Minnesota. And Miggy says he's fine. You know, talk. We're going to see you starting Friday night.
I don't believe a word out of Miggy. He's still not going to run the first base.
Yeah, I know.
And the other thing, as far as our left-handed pitcher goes, Boyd I'm talking about, if he comes out and he's really serious, because he certainly looks like he is because he's gotten such good shape, you know, he could probably win 12, 14 games in 60-game season. Because if he's as good as he looks, he's got a shot. And they have a shot. That's more important.
We have other topics to talk about. I don't think anything really.
Well, I got some NFL stuff we can talk about.
Go ahead. I got some great stories, but go ahead.
Okay, here we go. I'm reading the Palm Beach Post down here this morning, and they say the Miami Dolphins do not yet know if any fans will be permitted at their home games this season. Yeah. But get this. They've just announced no fans at training camp or at exhibition games. So if they're not going to allow fans at the preseason games, my guess is this entire season could be in trouble. And we have a situation now, I know you guys saw this, where some of the most prominent players in football over the weekend, you know, Russell Wilson says his wife's pregnant. He says the NFL haven't done enough stuff to make sure that we're safe. Drew Brees said that also. Mm-hmm. Other guys said that. Man, I've been saying, I don't know if they're going to play or not. I think it might be wishful thinking.
I think it's wishful thinking for the NFL. Well, they can play with no fans, but still, football is so different with all the contact and the spitting and the close proximity. It seems like, whereas baseball, they're 50 feet apart, or they can easily stay 10 feet apart except at the plate.
You know what they're talking about doing, Eli? Did you see this? They're talking about creating plastic shields that start underneath your helmet at the top cover your entire face. I hope you'll be able to hear the center calling out line blocking schemes. And I don't know.
J.J. Watt said, that's absurd. I fall on my face all the time when I play. What's going to happen to that shield? Is it going to break? Is it going to crack in my face? It's absurd. It's absurd. But they're all just guessing. The Eagles say no fans. No fans at all the entire season. Others are like hoping to have the Ravens announced the capacity will set to 14,000, which is 81% less than the normal capacity, all over the board.
Here's the testing results that they both leagues just did, the NBA and the NFL. And you tell me who's doing the better job, although I think they're even. The NBA tested a majority of players, and they only, believe it or not, they only had 5 come back positive, which is a great testimony to the guys that are staying in at this point in time. And as far as the NFL goes, they tested the majority of the players there also, and only 72 came back positive. 72 is not a lot when you think about how many people they had to test. Think about that. What is it, 45, 70 players on each team?
And then they got to sit out 10 days. That's the medical protocol.
That's right.
If they're okay, then like DJ LeMahieu out of Birmingham Brother Rice, the Yankee star, just sat out 10 days. He's just fine. So now he can come back. Now, the NFL's owners have voted to block off the first 8 rows at stadiums this season if they do play. The vote was 31-1. Who was the only NFL owner not to block, not to vote for that? Why?
Jerry
it was
Jones.
Mark Davis of the Raiders. Because after moving to Las Vegas, screwing their loyal fan base again, these guys sold almost $500 million in personal seating licenses. And then the tickets for their entire 2020 season sold out quickly. And many of those have already been resold on the secondary market. The Raiders do not want to have to pay massive refunds to all these people. But as far as I'm concerned, a pox on their house. If they do, they do.
Did you see the story? Time out. Did you see the story today? Mark Davis, who took over for his father, Al, says no spectators all year long. So with all the money they sold, he says the safety is number one. No fans in the ballpark.
Okay, good for him. Today. That's an update. I did not see
that.
That
happened today. Of course, no. Speaking of the players with infections, they got the snitch line in. In Orlando, and so Dwight Howard.
we got college football time for a moment.
Story.
Go ahead.
Dwight Howard gets reported on the snitch line, and his response to it: somebody told on me. Isn't that what happened in third grade? He told on me. She told on me. And, now Rudy Gobert, who was the guy who shut down the NBA when he tested positive on March 10th or 11th, whatever it was, called it petty. He goes, I think it's more about respecting each other and all do it in a small community. The problem is it a rule or isn't a rule? If it's a rule, you follow it. If it isn't a rule, then you don't have to follow it, and it screws everything up.
You don't have to worry about a rule. You know why? It's tough to hide a guy that's 7 foot tall.
No, you're right about that. And you know what, Eli and Danny, this extends to the entire Black Lives Matter thing, because black kids, apparently black lives don't matter to them. Black males in the inner cities are still murdering each other.
They're
murdering each other every day. And the problem is when one black kid murders somebody else, you can't snitch. You don't tell. You don't help the police.
What did you say? You just said black lives don't matter to black people. You just said.
I did not. To these black people, apparently they don't.
Oh, goodness.
Listen to what I'm saying for a change. Now, we've had all of these murders going on. As I said, did you see in Detroit the other, it was Sunday night. Sunday night, they murdered 3 kids sitting in some kind of a Coney Island restaurant on Joy Road. I bet nobody's going to snitch.
This brings up the huge police problem in America. And so much lying and so much misrepresentation in the media about what defund the police means and all that. You have to just create a system where people, I was brought up, my mom told me, if you have a problem, ask a policeman. They were my friends. Of course, till I started smoking weed, they were my friends. but they were my friends. And so how can we just get to the point we can stop the killing in black neighborhoods if people will just believe the police, or the police can be trusted, or the police. So it's just, it's so tragic.
They had a funeral last week in New York City for an adorable, I've seen pictures, adorable one-year-old girl who was murdered, killed in some kind of a crossfire. And who shows up? Of course, Al Sharpton. And it was Al Sharpton himself who said, you know, we talk about Black Lives Matter, but they got to matter to us, too.
That's right.
It's got to start with us. And it just hasn't been happening. I don't care what you're talking about, New York, Detroit, Chicago, wherever you go, it's just so bad.
I was thinking when there was the pushback to the Black Lives Matter phrase, and the announcer, the announcer in Sacramento that got fired for saying all lives matter, it would have been much easier if they said Black Lives Matter as much, would have solved all that controversy, because all lives do matter. But it was the misuse of the misunderstanding of the phrase, whatever. And
the attacks that are going on right now. Did you see again over the way? It's beginning to sound like a news program. I'm sorry, folks, if you don't like that. But we had a situation in New Jersey on Sunday where a delivery man came to the door of a United States federal judge, a woman.
Yeah.
Her son, 21 years old, opens the door. The guy immediately shoots him in the heart and murders him. Then he attacks her husband. He couldn't find the judge because apparently she was down in the basement doing something. It's almost open season now on law enforcement officials in our country. And that's so sad and so pathetic.
Mm-hmm. Can I go back a second here? We were talking about fans at games. I wanted to throw this in before we move on to something else. We talk about the NFL and the other leagues. College football is the one that's really got a big question mark. There's no commissioner. There's no unified center. Each conference kind of acts independently. And Mark Emmert, who was the head of the NCAA, the association's president, said, today, the data point in the wrong direction. If there is to be college sports in the fall, we need to get a much better handle on the pandemic. If we don't get a better handle on the pandemic in the next, month? The college football season starts in a month. We're not going to have it.
It's not going to happen.
Yeah, we have failed. Most athletes are young, healthy people, but the bigger risk is for the population around them.
And here's another big risk.
One second, Bob. But there's one thing I'd like to see, because they're talking about Notre Dame and Alabama playing the first game. I'd like to see that game, and then they can shut it down.
If they're not playing it in front of any fans, Denny, I don't want to see that game. What is it? It's just a scrimmage otherwise.
Yeah, the casinos will be open by then.
All right. So I was going to bring this up, Eli, a couple minutes ago, but there's something that I don't think most of us think about very much. An interesting story in the Detroit News about this, and they're talking about the businesses in college towns. I don't like South Bend, Denny, like Tuscaloosa, like East Lansing, and like Ann Arbor. So a study of Big Ten football games just in the state of Michigan, this is 13 years ago, found that there were roughly 1.37 million people in attendance at Michigan and Michigan State game. And that economic impact, money spent, was $88.7 million to the state's economy. Same company, 2013 season, determined that $12 million per home game is injected into the local economies in Ann Arbor, in East Lansing, and elsewhere. And they quote Keith McKendry. I don't know this place, but he owns Ann Arbor's popular Mr. Spot's restaurant. It's right on State Street downtown. And he said, these are our seven biggest days of the year. Right there, football Saturdays. What are we going to do if no fans show up? Mm-hmm.
Well, the Big Ten just reported how much each university made last year from all of the things that go around a football game. Each MSU was given $55.6 million at the end of the year.
You know, that's from TV and all that stuff. Yeah. I had one of these headlines, like I mentioned earlier, where the ones with the social messaging, the one where Sports Illustrated got a transgender model. I got another one. I got to tell you a headline that I have to look at and say, really? The apocalypse has to be here. But first, I want to tell you that Luke Nowacki, of Pinnacle Wealth Strategies. He's been a great supporter of our show. We hope you will support him. Luke has had been doing this for 20 years, dealt with all kinds of individuals, families, business owners too, to help them with their financial situation, get peace of mind about the future. So you should give Luke a call at 248-663-4748. Most of us spend a lot less time than we should on our investments and really understand where things are. Go call Luke and then create a plan to help you reach all your financial goals. He'll answer all the questions you may have. And of course, the consultation is complimentary. If you're young and need to balance and plan for future obligations, or if you're nearing retirement, call Luke. He will let you know what you need to do and listen to him. And if you decide to go forward, that's great. In any case, you should call him at 248-663-4748. Luke Nowacki, Pinnacle Wealth Strategies, advisory service author, Royal Alliance Associates, Inc., other marketing names, product, service, revenues here, independent of Royal Alliance Associates. And of course, it is still a great time to refinance. And when you do, you got to call David Hall and Hall Financial. They are a great sponsor of us and the entire Red Shovel Network for good reason. They do a great job. They got 1,500 five-star reviews for Michigan homeowners alone. You can go to their webpage, David Hall Financial, and get started, or call 248-308-5000. If you haven't refinanced in the last year, now's the time. Lower your monthly payments. And by refinancing, you probably skip up to a payment or two. Don't worry about the coronavirus. Of course, we're all worried about it. But in terms of your house, don't worry about it. The appraisal can be done without someone stepping foot inside your house. So again, 248-308-5000. Hall Financial, lower payments, better options, more personal attention. You're listening to the No Filter Sports Podcast. So I'm looking again, I see these headlines, and here's the headline. Mike Tyson to fight shark as comeback takes bizarre twist. I'm thinking, come on, are you serious? I mean, Jesse Owens raced a horse, Ali fought a wrestler, Foreman fought five guys in a night, but please, this can't be a true story. I guess it's some type of tape thing on Shark Week, and he's obviously not going to fight a shark. I would think underwater he would have a great disadvantage getting his right cross to move more than a couple of inches a second.
Eli, this is your sport, boxing, and so you know better than anybody. There's nothing more pathetic in the world than a fighter who's no longer in the headlines. They'll do anything to get back in the headlines.
Here's what's so funny. He goes, his experience at Shark Week. He still says, I'm able to step up to the challenge of overcoming anything that will prevent me from accomplishing my life's mission of reaching my highest potential in life and bringing me closer to God. So can you see it now? Mike's at the pearly gates. He's got his head under one arm because the shark ate the other arm before biting off his head. God says, Mike, you got your wish. You're real close to me right now. Go get your corona swab. I'll set you up to meet Jesus, and the angel's housekeeper will fit you for your wings. Crazy. Crazy, crazy. But
you know, the problem with that scenario is somebody could really get hurt. I mean, they might be doing this as a joke, but man, somebody's going to get one whack one time and send them from here to the planet of Mars. I mean, he's never going to know what hit him. He's never going to know where he wakes up.
And it'll cut short.
Speaking of outrageous, over the weekend, Jeremy Roenick filed a big lawsuit against NBC TV, wrongfully firing him over his infamous, or famous, I should say, threesome comments, saying the network has held him to a different standard than the other people on the air. So if you guys remember this, on a December 18th episode of Barstool Sports, I hear this is a good show, I haven't heard of Spit and Chicklets, JR joked about the possibility that he would go to bed and have a threesome with his wife and a hot coworker on NBC, Catherine Tappan.
Oh,
okay,
God.
Big deal. So what? BFD. And for that, the PC morons have decided that Jeremy Roenick's broadcast career is now over.
Well, that's politically correct.
Do you blame him for firing him?
Well, in context.
I do.
In
that's
context,
harmless.
In context,
Brandon, go ahead.
He was
Brandon.
Discussing being out and about with his coworker and his wife and getting looks from people who believe, wow, this guy's with these two hot chicks. And so that was what, you know, he was joking around with some buddies and on that show. And yeah, it ultimately led to his firing. But now his case is the fact that he is claiming heterosexual discrimination.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Because also Tara Lipinski and Johnny Weir have made some pretty racy comments in public as well, yet they haven't been fired. So this is kind of new
territory. And it's a
show
geared to people your age, Brandon, and younger. It's a no-holds-barred show where they can say anything they want to. Leave it alone. Let's just move on.
You'd think we were past this prudishness that we can't talk about things in jest. It's pathetic. Did you see this story? Another headline I should have mentioned that blows my mind. $1.845 million
for LeBron's rookie card.
Is that crazy? Oh, my God. It's only 17 years old. How can it be worth that much? They only made 23 of them. I guess it's what's it called? It was.
Well, that's rarity, then.
It's
a rarity.
It's the life of a billionaire, bud. That's what
Man,
it is.
Yeah, what a thing to spend your money on in the middle of a pandemic. Yeah,
it's amazing. Hey, Eli, do you have anything like on this day in sports?
Because
we got the mailbag, and I have no idea what kind of time we have left on the show.
Well, we're getting in there. Okay. I tell you, this day in sports, there's so many great things today. Let me see here. Well, in 2009, I was heartbroken when Tom Watson at age 59 missed an 8-foot putt that could have won the British Open and made him the oldest champion of all time. He pushed the putt and lost to Stewart Cink. Remember that. This day in 2020, by the way, Mike Ilitch's birthday is today. He was born in 1929.
Happy birthday, Mike.
You ready for this, Denny? Because Ted Williams tried to get you to lose two games in a day. Wilbur Wood of the White Sox started and lost both games of a doubleheader to the Hank Aaron hit a 755th.
Well, he was a knuckleballer. I mean, he could pitch both games of a doubleheader, Wilbur Wood. I mean,
and speaking of knuckleballers, it was on this day in 72, the Dodgers released knuckleball pitcher Hoyt Wilhelm. He was 50 years old, had pitched for the Cardinals, the Giants, the Indians, the Orioles, the White Sox, the Angels, the Braves, the Cubs, and the Dodgers in a 20-year career. He learned the knuckler as a teenager. And I remember I was 8 or 9 years old, and they showed the glove. I guess it was the Orioles catcher. Was it Gus Triandos, maybe?
Gus was one of them. And Joe Ginsburg, of course, was one of them, too. And I saw Wilhelm pitch at an exhibition game in Florida from the front row in 1961. And my dad kept yelling at Joe Ginsburg every time a pitch got away, "Get a stick and kill it, Joe! Get a stick and kill it, Joe!"
He was...
Eli, the ironic thing about this, and I know this is something that Denny does know, Wilhelm did not throw a knuckleball. He threw a fingernail ball. That was his grip on the ball.
But it was a knuckleball.
It was a knuckleball.
He didn't throw with his knuckles. He threw it with his fingernails.
But
on the
he
ball.
Threw him off his knuckle. Honest to God, you know
that's the way knuckleballs.
We all tried to learn how to throw a knuckleball. Whenever he came into the ballpark, he'd hold a session down there for 20, 30 minutes, and there isn't one person that ever walked out of there that was any better than he was before he started. I mean, he just had a touch. And by the way, Gus Triandos caught my first major league game.
Did he?
And guess who's now available, Eli? Danica Patrick.
You told us. Yeah, right.
Yeah, I'm going to call Aaron today and see, I don't know what I'm going to do.
Talk about the beauty and the beast. You go from Gus Triandos to Danica Patrick.
By the way, before I'm done, Wilhelm still holds the record for 124 wins in relief, retired with a 2.52 ERA, one of the lowest in history. And the last thing is, on this day in 1994, O.J. Simpson offered $500,000 for evidence of his ex-wife's killer. I guess he never had to pay off on this.
And that's another can of worms we need to open today, maybe for another show at another time.
Okay,
let's do the mailbag now. I know Denny does. Kidding. Denny
let's bang out the mailbag. Go ahead.
Here we go. You can tweet us all at Eli Zarrett, at MU2Denny, or at Bob Page Sports. This tweet came to me from Jelly Roll. That's just how he bills himself. Great show and interview with Johnny Grubb today. I always listen twice, which is why I'm so informed. We, the American audience, need a third show, guys. I'm just saying that. It is time to engineer a CD with all or at least some of your interviews, and I am in for $50 as a contribution to the show. I mean, fellas, can you imagine this? From humble beginnings here, now we get a request to produce a Best of No Filter Sports podcast CD. Oh, and Eli, it just dawned on me the other day that you've stopped telling everybody how to contribute to the show and to the Gleaners Food Bank in Detroit as well, right?
Yeah, I decided I was going to stop begging for donations. But yes, you can certainly hit the donate button. We'd love to have you donate whatever you can. $5 a month would be great. A one-time thing, doesn't matter. Help us out. We'd appreciate to meet our expenses.
Friend of the show, Jimmy Lyons, tweeted me, really enjoyed the interview with Johnny Grubb, Bob. Also loved Eli recounting the double Johnny hit in the top of the 11th off Quisenberry in game two. I was 14 years old, and I remember that like it was yesterday. Friend of the show, Kurt Kosmowski, said, guys, another great interview this time with Johnny Grubb. The best part of your interviews is hearing how appreciative the former players all are for their time in the game. Hearing Johnny Grubb say he learned how to hit left-handed by throwing rocks up and hitting them was so great. Just the simplicity of it and his love for the game. Today's kids only play organized ball, and they walk around with their name on their jerseys and $1,000 worth of name brand gear. And it's sad because they're missing out on the simple fun of the game of baseball.
Well, yeah, I think one thing we're doing, and you and I are big fans. Who's the guy that wrote Glory of His Times? Was it Lawrence Ritter? Is that who wrote Glory of Our Time?
Yes, he went Lawrence
around
Ritter.
With a little, he went around with a little reel-to-reel recorder and drove to talk to all the baseball players from the turn of the century just to have their record on tape, you know, before the whole thing, before they died. So I kind of think of that. Not that we're going to anticipating Frank Tanana or dying anytime soon, John Grubb, but it is kind of a longer look and get to hear them about some of the questions that they might not have otherwise been asked. And by the way, Bob, the listener, they don't do CDs anymore. We're not going to make a CD. People don't listen to CDs anymore.
Well, that's up to Brandon.
Why don't we make a reel-to-reel tape or an 8-track tape or a cassette tape, and we can distribute those? And by the way, right. Got to say goodbye to our...
Brandon, do we really have to cut the show off?
No, we don't. Stop. We have to say goodbye to our radio audience.
Oh, okay, it's for the radio. Okay.
Yeah, for the 15 people listening down in Toledo, thank you very much on WCWA.
Well, Denny says it's half. Denny says it's half the police force.
We've got a crowd down there. They are listening to the show.
Go, Eli, go.
And they have been listening to the No Filter Sports Podcast. Now you may finish the bag.
All right. Jeff York, I think, wrote us at asknofilter@gmail.com. You can write us there. He says, hey, boys, I'm a bit behind on the show right now, but I want to chime in on your Ken Holland interview. I got a lot of respect for Kenny for what he did for our beloved Red Wings, but I just can't look the other way when it comes to his mistakes. The long-term high salary contracts and the bewildering free agent signings of aging veterans make me wonder if he was under pressure from the Ilitches to win now. The rebuild should have started much sooner than it did in my mind. Hoping you guys will weigh in on that subject. I love the show and don't stop ragging on each other.
Most teams do wait too long to rebuild.
Yes.
Didn't Denny, you said that about the 68 Tigers? They waited until the mid, or I forget who said that on our show.
We did.
Waited until 75. I mean, Willie Horton was still there in 76, and Mickey Stanley and Freehan, they all stumbled to the end of their careers. Only Kaline retired. So teams tend to do that. You fall in love with your guys, and they're the guys you drafted and traded for. And I think if Ken's guilty of that, I'm sure he is, but he's not alone. Go ahead.
Yeah. I'm sorry, Bob. There's almost a silence of thank you when it's time for the guys to move on. And I think it takes a year or two for management, especially if the player is close and living in the market, that in fact, it takes a lot of guts to say, hey, listen, Willie or Bill or Bob, see ya. We got to make this club better again in the future. So,
right. And I would just add to Jeff York that I think Kenny did a great job of defending himself. He doesn't need us. Yep. And basically it was, you just can't win them all. But whenever someone says they're running behind on listening to the recordings of our shows, we're just thankful that so many of you people do listen. Even a tweeter named Scott, who wrote me yesterday that he was falling behind on the shows and hoped that we would have Jim Abbott on with us sometime soon. I tweeted back, Scott, you're way behind on the shows. Way behind on the shows. Now, it turns out, and to borrow from Mr. Lennon, I should have known better, that it was our boy Iffy the Dopester who had tweeted out that amazing interview Denny did in his prime on the Dick Cavett Show, which we talked about last week. Again, you got to see this interview, folks, on YouTube. Now, Iffy posted another great pic on Twitter, and this one goes to Eli Zarrett. If he wrote, it's August 15th, 1965, and these folks you see are walking into Shea Stadium, but not to see a Mets game, to see the Beatles. Mm-hmm. The Yankees had played the KCAs earlier that day at Yankee Stadium, and no doubt some players made their way to Shea that night for the historic first ever stadium concert. Eli, you were in high school, such a hipster. Eli, did you go to that show?
I did not go. You know
why not, Eli?
Because I was 15 years old and I didn't have a driver's license, And I lived on Long Island, not far, but I had no way of getting there, really. And no, I didn't go.
Your big brothers couldn't take you?
In retrospect, I wish I had, because I was a huge Beatle fan like the rest of America. But no, well, I
thank goodness for your big brothers, because they were the guys who actually took you to your first baseball game at Ebbets Field.
And by
in
the way, I told you also in 1965 when the Beatles were there, I did go into Queens, which is very near Shea Stadium, to watch the Clay Liston rematch. I was very much more interested in that than the Beatles. But go ahead.
So listener Dominic Vitale, you guys will dig this. You ready for this? Listener Dominic Vitale is back with another of his This Week in No Filter Sports from 1 year ago on the show. Among just some of the highlights he picked out. Wow. Denny hated the British Open Championship won by Sean Lowry, who, by the way, has been a great champion.
Lowry.
Sorry about that. Maybe I just mistyped it. Anyway, so he says as a side note, you ready for this? Eli and Denny don't know bleep at all about golf. I used to play on the tour. Bob doesn't think golf is a sport. No, I don't. It's a great game. If golf is a sport, who then are the athletes?
Nobody's ever played on the tour. Send us pictures and some clippings about all the money you won.
Okay, I'm coming to that. Okay. Now, he also wrote that Denny said on the show, Tiger should retire. And we've already talked about that here, and I agree with that. Denny, do you still feel that way? Just to get back for a second to what we had said?
I think he's got to get himself ready for the senior tour. That's what I think he's got to do.
Okay.
And get back there and put the excitement back in the game. You know what? If you don't have an exciting guy like Tiger or Nicklaus or Palmer, somebody that can rally the troops again. And he can when it's his time. And it's coming up pretty soon.
All right. That's enough, Tiger. Go ahead.
Right. He writes that
Hang on a minute.
We already talked about Tiger.
Wait a minute. You can ask a 4-minute question and we can't get 13 seconds.
You already had the conversation before.
That's okay. Bob and I are talking.
Go ahead. No material. Go ahead. You're running out of time.
Shall I continue, you mean? Or you got something else you want to say, Dan?
No, go ahead. No.
I'm going to go. So I also said, he writes, that Lee Westwood had no chance to win the British Open. I'm really not a big fan. Yet Denny said he did have a chance. Bob was right. Lee cannot close.
He can't chip and putt is the problem, but go ahead.
Yeah, Bob said on the show that if Michigan doesn't beat Ohio State, Harbaugh's going to be gone. I was wrong about that. But Eli said it was all going to change last year, and it did not. Eli laughingly claims that Denny almost took his head off with a shank golf shot.
I'm still shuddering at the thought. It was so close.
Oh, okay. And I did check Dom's claim of being a golfer on the internet. And he's right. There's a lot of stuff about him. He did play on one of the minor league tours. He turned pro in 2004. So look, if you've ever played pro golf, you're an amazing player. You know what I'm saying?
But I disagree don't tell me I know nothing about
to golf. Get on one of the tours. That's pretty impressive.
Yeah.
Any
tour. That's true.
And fellas, would you like to take a guess at Dominic Vitale's career winnings?
$150.
$238.86.
That was close.
Career winning. So you can also call or text us 760-89-BALLS. And a frequent topic here is Denny's late great father-in-law, Lou Boudreaux. Ty Emelander says, you guys mentioned Boudreaux on Thursday. I think if you Google the greatest MLB seasons, Lou, and Denny get overlooked. Lou was not only the MVP, but also the manager of the 1948 World Series champions. And I guess we all know what Denny McClain did in 68. And
I don't think that gets overlooked at all. Denny's does get overlooked.
Well, I don't know how many people here. Brandon's a great example. Before we started this show, Brandon, at your age, which is now 36, had you ever heard the name Lou Boudreaux?
You know, maybe in passing, I didn't.
But that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about Denny McClain's season being overlooked.
Boudreaux is underappreciated. That's what we're talking about.
Because he's so
I'm sure
so long
Denny
ago.
Agrees with me.
Back in his day, I'm sure he was, but certainly these days.
Well, I think most of the players back then were all undervalued.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then we didn't have the media back then that we do today.
Right. Or TV. Go ahead.
Yeah.
So, and then finally, this one comes from Randall Best at a website. I gave all the information. Of course I did. Right. So at our website, asknofilter@gmail.com. And Randall writes, as Bob has mentioned several times on the show, his parents were Duke grads. I wonder whether he was a Duke fan growing up. My parents also were Duke grads. And I well remember the glory days of Vic Bubas. My parents talked about him all the time. And Dick Groat. And great players like Art Heyman, Jeff Mullins, Jack Maron, and Bob Verga. You know, I watched with my mother the 1964 NCAA Final Four game on TV between Michigan and Duke, and I grew up a wacko Michigan fan. So I well remember all the great Duke players. But yeah, Eli and I were talking about this the other day. We're trying to get Cassie Russell on the show.
Yeah, got to get Cassie.
Cassie Russell was the reason Eli went to Michigan.
Was it Jeff Mullen on that 64 team?
Jeff Mullins. Yeah. And he played in the NBA a long time. So yeah. Mullins was on that team. Jack Maron played with the Bulls for a long mm-hmm. time. Bob Verga. And Art Heyman. Yeah. I don't know if you, well, Eli, you should know this. But when Art Heyman was finished playing with the Knicks, he opened a couple bars in New York City. And he called them Dukes. I used to go to the one in the Village. It's now closed. And I still go to the other Dukes just a few blocks away from where we live in the East Midtown area of Manhattan. But, you know, you talk about Cassie, Bill Bunton, Oliver Darden, Larry Tregoning of Ferndale.
George Pommy.
Yes, George, and Billy Cantrell, Dave Strack, the head coach. Michigan lost to Duke 91-80 in that game. And I can still see my mother gloating at me while I was so upset. And then Duke went on to the NCAA championship game where they lost to UCLA.
And I think the next year, Michigan made it to the finals and they
played UCLA.
Gail Goodrich beat them. All right. Hey, can we move on to our feature interview now? You said
I'm
7.
Done. Yeah. Let's
760-89 yeah. is the number. And let's talk to the great Tiger former general manager, I think a future Hall of Famer too, Dave Dombrowski.
No question about it.
In 2003, the year after Dave Dombrowski took the reins of the Tigers, the team lost an AL record 119 games, had missed the playoffs 14 straight years. But just three seasons later in 06, after Dombrowski fueled the roster with an assortment of draft picks and free agents, they lost 52 fewer games. One of his many timely acquisitions was Maglio Ordóñez, who sent the city into a frenzy with a dramatic pennant-clinching blast.
The 1-0, swinging a fly ball, left field, it's deep, it's way back! The Tigers are going to the World Series! Three-run walk-off home run! Oh, man! The Tigers have beat the A's 6-3, completed a four-game sweep in one of the greatest turnarounds in baseball history.
And now after taking the Red Sox to their 2018 World Series title, Dave is embarking on a new adventure as part of a group looking to bring Major League Baseball to Nashville. We'll get into that soon enough, but first, Dave, welcome, and got to ask you, what comes to mind when you hear Dan Dickerson's vocal cord damaging call from way back in 06?
Well, thank you, first of all. Secondly, I have to admit, I still get the goosebumps when I hear that. It's amazing, the great memories and the feelings and everything attached with that growth period. But during that postseason right there, 2006, and sweeping that series with the A's, when I hear that, and I remember just jumping up and down and hugging people and being around everyone that had been through it with us. Great memories for me.
Why, David Denny, why Nashville? Is there a group that you've joined? Have you been commissioned to jump on this with a partnership or something?
You know, Nashville, a few reasons behind that. First of all, just kind of waiting to see what would take place in the next year after I left the Red Sox organization, and was contacted by this group. I'd met the individual that really put this group together preliminarily. His name is John Lohr. He had traveled throughout the country and actually North America looking at prospective Major League Baseball cities, and he set up in Nashville at that time. Very impressed with John and the group of individuals he put together under the name Music City Baseball. The chairman he's actually asked to help, his name is Alberto Gonzalez. Alberto used to be the attorney general for George Bush, and was very impressed with them. Met with them, and they flew me into Nashville in December of last year. Ended up looking around the city at all the growth that took place, visiting with various individuals at that point. Talked to Major League Baseball. They encouraged me to do so. Major League Baseball, very optimistic about Nashville as a prospective Major League Baseball city, although no guarantees attached. And basically, when you're there and you travel around the big leagues all the time and you see where go to big league cities, you get to feel this is a big league city. Of course, they've got hockey and they've got the NFL, and they just actually added a soccer team. So that combination, working with the people, enjoying working with them, the plan that they had, them wanting me to come on board, they felt that they were in a position where they needed somebody that had a baseball background, They had done a lot of work behind the scenes, working with the city, with the government, with various individuals within the community, that they needed somebody that was familiar with baseball itself and the inner workings and how it would prospectively work if you did get an expansion or a relocation team. So it just seemed like a great opportunity, and one at this time of my life, after being in charge of a baseball operation for over 30 years and in the game for over 40 years, that it seemed like an interesting challenge worth partaking.
Well, since Denny brought up the Nashville issue, Dave, and we have so much to talk to you about, nowhere has it been written in anything I've seen what team you're going to get. I mean, baseball's so diluted, surely they're not going to come up with an expansion team for Nashville, which to me means you guys are going to steal probably one of the Florida teams, especially the Marlins, who can't draw your ex-team, the Marlins, who can't draw flies.
Well, that's a hard one to answer, and there's a few reasons behind that. First of all, and I know the commissioner a couple of years ago before this pandemic hit had talked that he'd ideally like to go to 32 teams because it makes it easier for scheduling purposes, but also that he wanted to make sure that there were a couple of franchises that were set, primarily Tampa and Oakland. And in Oakland, it sounds like they're making some strides there. Tampa, of course, is a question mark. Miami has a long-term lease, and they just built that ballpark, so I would think they'd have a difficult time relocating. But for us, even if you talk about relocation versus expansion, again, we would have to be open-minded to anything. But if it ended up with a relocation, we're really not a quick, viable alternative in Nashville because we don't have a ballpark where anybody can play at this time. Other cities would be more ideal for those scenarios, in Montreal or Charlotte. The only ballpark that we have right now is the AAA ballpark of the Nashville Sounds. It's a beautiful AAA park, but seats around 10,000 people, can only be expanded by a small amount. The Titan Stadium is not conducive to playing baseball there. And so if you were going to be in a relocation team, you'd have to be a lame duck in your franchise's city, because it's going to take us, with a retractable roof stadium, which we feel we need there, 24 to 30 months to build once everything gets put into place. So the other part of it is, when you talk about expansion, and you have no idea what Major League Baseball will decide to do, but if they do expand and you look at the basic agreement ending at the end of 2021, that's also a way that you take those expansion fees and multiply it by two, that those are dollars that are split up between Major League Baseball franchises, and the potential for them to add to their coffers as far as trying to make up some of the revenues that they lost. So who knows what will take place, but that is why potentially you could still see expansion taking place.
It seems like it's good you have a long-term plan, because right now baseball really, and the pandemic even notwithstanding, there's a lot of problems in the league. And I know you've been through, and basically you've been through strikes and all kinds of situations in your many years. But it will take some time, will it not? And the fact is, how does baseball's current status, meaning the mistrust and everything, play into the fact that it will take some time? And by the way, I must add also, you seem to have really been ahead of the curve in picking a diverse group of people, with a Hispanic Gonzalez, with Dave Stewart, etc. Was that by design? And I'm certainly you planned that before the whole George Floyd thing blew up America.
Yeah, I mean, I think first of all, when you get into the situation, I mean, baseball's in a difficult time right now. We know that. I mean, the world's in a difficult time with the pandemic, and nobody knows what's taking place, and we're all waiting for a vaccine before we'll get back to operating under somewhat of a normalcy, and nobody knows when that's going to take place. But in our situation there on baseball itself, kind of separating it, I mean, it's been a tough time period. You look at the negotiations that have taken place. We know that nobody's anticipated an easy basic agreement negotiations at the end of 2021 or leading into that time period. So all we can do is remain hopeful and that the game gets back in the area in which we need it to focus on. But we've also been in spots when we've gone through tough times in the game that once you get settled and once those things get accomplished, that the game bounces back because it's such a great game. And that's what we have to hope takes place. And for us, we're not talking about playing until 2024, 2025. So we're talking a way down the line. And so hopefully the game will bounce back by then. As far as diversity, extremely important in today's world. And actually, before I was there, Alberto Gonzalez was on board, Dave Stewart was on board, and it's something that we continue to emphasize with our diversity being emphasized in every respect. When you look at all the social injustice and what's taking place, the racial equality conversations nowadays, it's a point of emphasis. We have our name, it'd actually be the Nashville Stars, which was decided upon before I joined them, which would be the first Major League Baseball team named after a Negro League team. That name has been purchased from the Negro League Hall of Fame. They're in a position where we're actually sharing some revenues with the Hall of Fame there. And so we have a diversity oversight committee we're forming at this point. So I think in today's world, it's extremely important before all this took place, but even more so now. And it is something that's been emphasized from day one with the franchise.
The two $64,000 questions. First, what happened to you with the Tigers? Did they force you to rebuild? You fought it, and then they fired you? Secondly, what the hell were the Red Sox thinking when they fired you during a game against the Yankees the year after you'd won the World Series in Boston?
Well, I mean, going back, you know, first of all, with the Tigers, it had been a situation, been there for a long time. We had a lot of great, you know, great times, and we really were on quite a run. We had a down year that particular year, which was in 2015. It was not our better year. We had a lot of injuries that ended up hitting us with our ball club at that particular time. And really, you know, I'd been there a long time, and sometimes, you know, it's just time for a change. I had always had a good relationship with Mr. I, and we'd worked closely together. And I think in his mind, he just felt, well, we hadn't won the whole thing, and I'm going to give somebody else the opportunity to do so. So they really, when I left at that point, Mr. I had not talked about rebuilding. He was still focused towards trying to win, and you could see the moves. The next year, they added, I think, Zimmerman and Upton, and their moves were more focused on trying to win. Knowing at some point there was going to be a rebuilding process there and need to get some talent, which I know they've done, and they've really acquired some talent in that regard. But I think it was more just, okay, you've been there a long time, but we just haven't won the whole thing, and let's make that change. With the Red Sox, very difficult one for me to totally even understand myself. You know, sometimes you just kind of respect that ownership has the ability to do whatever they want. We won three straight divisional titles and, you know, won the World Series in 18 and then in 19. Again, we didn't have a good year. It was not as – we felt we had a better club than 84 wins. We did have an injured pitching staff. And really coming out of the gate, like a lot of times you – and it's not a good excuse, but you're in a spot you can just see you're not quite as focused. You don't play quite as well. And then we got on a pretty good run and – we're playing pretty well, but the pitcher's injuries caught up to us, and owners just felt that they wanted to make a change. And again, you respect what they have to do. You don't have to agree with it, but it's their ability to do whatever they would like to do.
You know about making changes. You came here in 2002. The team hadn't made the playoffs in 14 years. You fire Garner and Randy Smith 6 games in the 2002 season. You just grab it by the throat. You make so many moves. You talk about getting hard-throwing pitchers. You signed Ivan Rodriguez. You signed Kenny Rogers, Ordóñez, who we heard for drafted Verlander. And later on, you even got in a brilliant trade with Miami. You got Cabrera for 2 of your draft picks, Cameron Maybin, now here for the third time, I believe, in Andrew Miller. When you look back at the many, many moves you made and how you took this moribund franchise and brought such pride to the city, what are you proudest of? What stands out to you?
Well, really, I think it was one where, you know, when I came over there in the beginning, and when I say I, but then we, there were a lot of people that joined me in the organization at that particular time that came over. And I think really just, Bill, we were not very good when I joined us as far as the big league club, but also within the system itself. We did not have a lot of depth in our talent at that point. And so really it was a major rebuilding job at that time. And I think that when I compare to what the Red Sox were, it was apparent when I went to the Red Sox in 2015 and I joined them in August and had a chance to watch them in August and September. I mean, we had a lot of tremendous young positional players, not a lot of pitching, but positional players. When you looked at the Betzes and the Bradleys and the Bogarts and some of the guys in the minor league system, like Benintendi and Devers and Christian, but the list went on and on. Well, with the Tigers, we really didn't have that type of talent. So you knew you were going to have to rebuild, and not only rebuild talent wise, but rebuild from a mental perspective, because I think at that point, There was probably too much acceptance of, hey, we're just not very good. We're the Tigers, and we need to build back in that regard. So I think for me, taking the franchise that was really struggling at that point and with everybody else involved, building it back where we were a respected franchise, a good franchise, one of the top ones on the field, and also at the point of drawing 3 million people in the ballpark at that time. So I think we are one of the most respected franchises in baseball. And every year, I mean, I used to laugh at the end because the people in the commissioner's office that would work in the postseason say, oh, but we're back again, we're back again, we're back again. And we really had a good organization. And it is a shame. The part that would be my biggest regret would actually be when I look back, that it's hard to believe, as good as we were, that we didn't win a world championship. I mean, we were just, when you look at the talent on that club and you look at the overall talent, and in recent times, you start talking about Justin Verlander. Well, there's a Hall of Famer. Max Scherzer, there's a Hall of Famer. Miguel Cabrera, there's a Hall of Famer. And many other people that were really great players. And we just never quite got over the hump at that point to win the whole thing. But the ability to have the type of club that we did, where year in and year out, you knew we were really good, quality people, worked in the community, build a franchise that everybody be proud. I'd say that was my biggest, for me, the part that you feel the most happy about and the most complete about.
I'll tell you, the most impressive thing is when you had the three pitchers, you had Price, Verlander, and Scherzer there all at the same time. That was unbelievable. I mean, you had the three best pitchers in the history of the game on one club.
History of the game.
And Purcell, who went on to win a Cy Young.
Yeah, that's right. Let me ask the question. I got something to lead with here. You really didn't want to leave Boston. In fact, are you still under contract with them at this point in time?
I'm through the end of August, through the end of October here this year, so I have one more year that they're paying me through. And so it's a situation. No, I did not want to leave Boston. It was not a desire. I actually thought when we were here and what we had accomplished, I think that we thought this would probably be our last stop as far as running the club is concerned. And who knows what would take place from there. But again, sometimes life throws you curves, and you got to be ready to move and adjust to them.
I wouldn't know, David. I never had a good one, so I can't really give you an idea about a curveball.
I don't know. You had some pretty good ones.
Listen, I want to talk to you about stealing signs real quick. It's always been my position that if a manager and or a general manager is or isn't involved in this, wouldn't it be paramount that the manager, knowing that his players are stealing signs, wouldn't he have to go to the GM or the manager to talk about, can I do this? Can I get away with it? Wouldn't there be some kind of line of communication there?
Well, I would sure think so. I mean, that was something that, yeah, I think, yes, my answer to that would be yes. I know a couple of times we had situations here in Boston, which were surprising to me. I mean, we talked, I'll take the first Apple Watch situation. That was a situation that the players had pretty much set into place themselves. I know when that was brought to my attention, I was shocked. I didn't, because if something like that would have been brought to my attention or our front office attention, we'd have said immediately, you can't do something like that. That's against the rules. You got to stop it. And they didn't even bring that. The manager wasn't even aware, John Farrell, at that time. In 2018, when we ran into that, I'm still skeptical of what, when I read the commissioner's office reports, of what they found. I know that they ended up penalizing the Red Sox and they had to do that. I was not involved in the final decision, but I talked all the time to Alex Cora and we were on the same page. He had, of course, did what he did in 2017. He was apologetic. He's serving the consequences of that. But I think that if anything was put in place from a managerial perspective, would for sure have to talk to the general manager. And I know myself, the one reason I always felt comfortable is a person who really ran our video person, his name is JT Watkins, and he caught the brunt of it for Major League Baseball. He turned people into me at times that he felt violated what the rules were. He knew what the rules were. Here's a guy who was a graduate of West Point that was an Army Ranger that's about as straight as you could possibly be. And so for me, putting that brunt on him, I'm still questionable to this day. And I myself, you're not in the clubhouse during the game as a general manager, but you walk through before the game and after the game, and never felt that any of that type thing was going on. So Yes, I do think it's extremely important that you have that type of communication. And if a manager ever brought those type of things to me and say, hey, we can't do those things, and no, stop it, not allowable.
Dave, when we were boys, the Indians had Trader Frank Lane as their general manager. You remember that name if you didn't know him.
I sure do.
You are Trader.
I was fortunate enough to have met him, actually.
Well, that's great. And you are Trader Dave Dombrowski. They're still calling the Miggy deal one of the greatest in the history of baseball. You traded the people's choice, Curtis Granderson, who could have been mayor of Detroit, to get back, again, Max Scherzer. You sent a whole passel of guys to the White Sox to bring Chris Sale to Boston. You even traded Randy Johnson from Montreal to Seattle, which I think you may regret. So you were an Ivy League football player at Cornell. What made you into this, like, top baseball expert?
Well, I appreciate those comments. Yeah, probably trading Randy Johnson wasn't the highlight of my career, but it's funny when you look back at it how life is, because at that point I was with the Expos, and I'll get back to it, but it was a situation where we were trying to win right then. We had an owner in Charles Bronfman that wanted to win at that time. We ended up trading Randy Johnson, Brian Holman, and Gene Harris to Seattle. And actually, Randy, even though he was, of course, got a great arm, was probably at that point the least of our concerns of the other two, because they were very talented. We got Mark Langston, who happened to be the best pitcher in their league at that particular time. And we were going all out to try to win. And so we did end up getting a couple of draft choices. But going back to that situation, I was very fortunate. I love baseball and always did. And, you know, as a youngster, played baseball, but you know, never to the professional caliber of these guys. But it was one, I think I was very fortunate when I started with the White Sox organization to have a mentor like Roland Hemond, who was our general manager at point. Roland was a very successful general manager for years. And he worked for Bill Veeck when I first started, and then Jerry Reinsdorf. But Roland took me under his wings and helped me every step of the way, talked me and sent me out of the office and had me travel with our scouts to go evaluate talent at the amateur level and at the professional level. He sent me to the minor leagues and spent time with people. Paul Richards was our director of player development at that time. And Ken Silvestri, a longtime catcher and professional baseball, was his right-hand man. He'd send me with them and to spend hours. I mean, I traveled the buses from Appleton to Quad Cities, and so you got an exposure of what that was all about. Traveled to Latin America, sent me with a gentleman by the name of Angel Vasquez, where we'd go for a month at a time and travel all over. And then just being around Roland, he was not afraid of doing anything. He was always prepared to make trades. He taught me how to do that. We talk about players all the time and the value of players. And so I think just being around that type of environment and trying to always get better. And of course, when you have an owner like Bill Veeck in the beginning, as you know, Bill wasn't afraid to do anything.
to say the least.
It really kind of set the tempo for me in my career. And I was just very fortunate to be in the right place at the right time.
Yeah, you got to tell us about Bill Veeck and what he was like. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, being around Bill Veeck was, you know, I was just so fortunate. I mean, the way I often describe it, in 1978, when I started with the White Sox, and I was 21 years old at the time, coming out of college, I had another year to graduate for school, that when I started, there were about five or six people in the baseball operations of the organization only. That was it. Bill Veeck, of course, owned a team, but he was involved. Roland Hemond, Paul Richards. I mean, there's three legends, really.
Yeah.
And you could make arguments that Paul Richards and Roland Hemond could be in the Hall of Fame, just like Bill Veeck. And so at that time, you had more exposure to an owner or those baseball people than you would ever have in today's world. And so being around them, Bill always challenged you. He always emphasized that there was never a bad idea. He said, throw things out. If there's 100 ideas and you keep one of them, that's great. So he's always encouraged that type of participation. He treated everybody like they were part of the family. He was extremely intelligent. He used to read books. He had his peg leg at that point that he had to soak, much different than in today's world when you'd have a replacement of a limb. But at that time, he had to soak in a bathtub for a couple hours a day. And he would read about five books a week on different topics, not just baseball. So he was so well-read and so well-versed. and he just made you part of the family. And so for me, I couldn't have been more fortunate to be in that regard. And the people that used to come up there to visit Bill, because at that point, again, baseball much different. They had what they called the Bards Room, which was the writer's room there in Comiskey Park. Again, much different than today's world. Only men were allowed there. There was a bar set up, and they would sit there, and Bill Veeck would have people around him all night long, and they talk baseball. And I wasn't at that table with Bill. I was a little bit further away, but over the next year moved up closer. But as the evening went on and more people left that Bards Room, I could move up and just listen. And he had people like, I said, oh, there's Frank Lane. You would have Hank Greenberg would come up there. You'd have Lee McPhail would come up there. You'd have just one person after another that came up there. And I was just very fortunate to be able to listen to their conversations and them talk about life. But at that point, most of their conversations were baseball. And then to be in a position I could listen to those things. I mean, I always talk about how it's really, at that point, it was like going for a doctorate degrees in baseball, yeah, because where would you normally have that type of exposure? You really wouldn't have it anywhere.
And how ironic is you're still an undergrad at the time when you started there at 21. You met some people who you've been with for your entire career. You met Jim Leland there. He was a third base coach. You met Tony La Russa there, who's involved with you, not only in Boston, but he's involved with you with the new Nashville project. What's strange to me was, in every hour, as Bob brought up earlier, the strange departures you had in both Detroit and Boston. I think the one with the White Sox was the strangest. Ken Harrelson, they take out of the broadcast booth. What is in charge of the team? And he fires you. Who would have ever suspected? And yet you went from that to going out of the Marlins. But that one must have took you by surprise as much as any of the others.
Well, you know, again, life, that's what's interesting in the game. And life throws you all different type of situations. You know, I don't think I was surprised to be let go by Hawk. I was more surprised when he was named the general manager at that particular time coming from the broadcast booth. That was more probably the surprising thing to me. And, you know, we just were different. We just had a different way. I mean, you respect Hawk's baseball knowledge and his ability as a player and as a broadcaster. But, yeah, I think even if you talk to him at this point, it wasn't what he was really cut out to be. And we just had a different philosophy about certain situations. So, but, you know, it's interesting throughout the time period. Now at this point, Hawk called me when I left the Red Sox and called me and said he couldn't believe what took place and wished me well. And even when I got the Nashville situation, he sent me a note. So time has a way of changing things in the game, and you understand it. And, you know, it's an unusual occupation compared to most, as we all know, because owners change. When I originally left the Florida Marlins, I mean, it wasn't because anything had happened there. It was, we were getting a new ownership group and they were bringing somebody else in. And yeah, people react when you're somewhere 10 years in Major League Baseball, you're there probably longer than normal compared to most jobs. And that's not how other industries are necessarily. But in our game, it just works like that way. And you get caught up in it sometimes.
Could you ever envision an owner spending more than his wealth? And the reason I bring that up, the question is, did you ever think you'd see a $503 million man?
426.
No, I mean, I never would have envisioned those dollars when I first started. And of course, as the game has progressed, and it's always an interesting philosophy because actually my major in school was accounting. And I think What's always fascinating for me is that when I started with the White Sox, one of the things that helped me the most is, if you forget, free agency just started in 1977. So I joined them in 1978. The game changed dramatically. And one of my first responsibilities with the White Sox, even though I was in the baseball and the operation, was to draw up a budget. They didn't have a budget for the baseball operation.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it was, okay, I need you to draw. And when you're from an accounting background, that's easy. But what really helped me at that point was that all the expenses in the operation then fell on my lap on the baseball end of the operation, because I had to code them and put them into the proper accounts. And then I could ask people, that gave me the leeway to ask questions of people to make sure they were properly coded and what was involved in expense. So all of a sudden you're exposed to that at a young age, and you're very, very fortunate. So when you take it to where we are now, it's hard to believe. The only thing I will say in that regard is the owners that own teams nowadays, of course, much different than when I first started. Sure. In order to own a team today, you have to be basically a billionaire to buy a team. And in order to become a billionaire in whatever occupation that you work, you're usually very successful and smart. Now, that doesn't mean you know the game of baseball per se, but these individuals have made money, and when they're paying an individual those type of dollars, they think there's a reason why they're doing it, and there's a return on their investment that they think is going to pay off for them. And again, some of them have the ability to just say, I'm willing to do that. When I worked with Mike Ilitch in Detroit, I mean, there were times where we were in a spot where, I mean, he let us make the baseball decisions, but his philosophy was always, I don't want you to say no to good players. I want you to be able to, when I'd say, what's our budget? He'd say, well, let's talk about it. This is what our general budget is, but I want you to keep an open conversation with me about that as time went on. And at times when there were finances, I mean, maybe some of us said, hey, this guy's really a good player, but we're not so sure that the finances merit this type of deal. But in Mike Ilitch's case, he'd say, you know, let me worry about that financial perspective of this. Let's get that player because I think he helps us win. And so everybody has a different reason why they own teams. And if you have an owner that's in a position that they try to do what they can to win, they're willing to take risk too.
Last question. Go ahead, Bob.
Yeah, Dave, I got one last question for you. I know it was a thrill for you to join your hometown team. You're from Oakland, Illinois, outside of Chicago, in 1978, as you said. But what I want to know, where were you on that fateful night of July 12th, 1979?
Getting his degree at Western, but go ahead, answer the question.
He's with the White Sox already on disco.
That's not correct. I was with the White Sox sitting in the press box behind Bill Veeck in the next row behind him. So I was there for that whole thing because in 78, when I took that job with the White Sox, I then finished my last year in college through correspondence courses. They let me take it elsewhere. So I was actually with the White Sox. I was right there. I experienced the whole night. And I'm sure, well, we don't have enough time to talk about the whole evening now, because that's one of those nights that you remember the rest of your life, because there's so many different stories that we could talk about at that point. But it's really
interesting. Why did you guys let Steve Dahl do that?
Whose
fault was it?
Because he was anti-disco. Because he was anti-disco. He was pro-rock and roll. That's why, just like Dahl.
Yeah. I will tell you one thing that it's just one of the funniest moments of my career is the evening that we hired Alan Trammell as our manager officially with the Tigers. And we went out for dinner afterwards. And there was a small group of us of about 15 people. We went out for dinner in a private room. Mike Ilitch was there with us. And Tram was there. And at that time, working with us as a consultant heavily in our marketing department was Mike Veeck. And yeah, Mike Veeck was the person whose idea was Disco Demolition.
Yep.
So it was an interesting night because Mike Veeck and Alan Trammell had never met until that evening. And hearing Tram's perspective of playing shortstop, and Mike Veeck's perspective, whose idea was, it was a fascinating conversation between the two of them from the different perspectives. And of course, Tram liked it better because, as he said, you know what, the way I looked at it is we won the second game and we didn't even have to play. That was great.
Mike Veeck and I became real good friends over the years. And yet you may know something about his daughter and what have you. Exceptional human being to begin with. And every time I see him, and I still see him probably 4 or 5 times a year, I always bring up, you got any more letters? You got any more records from Capitol? And boy, you can get a look from Michael like you can't imagine.
Yeah. Well, he remains a very good friend of mine. And
good man.
Unfortunately, his daughter Rebecca passed away last year. But yeah, he's a tremendous man. And he's the one that officially offered me the job back in 1978 with the first offer officially. And we remain friends throughout the years.
Yeah, and congratulations, by the way, on being a Lou Boudreau Hall of Fame inductee. I'm sure you're aware of his
role. Now you're going to get Denny going on that.
No, okay, we got to cut it off there. Dave, I think
that's one I'd be wise enough to not touch, but I appreciate it.
So, hey, Dave, best of luck with Nashville. Really appreciate you taking the time with us today. And I think it'd be great to see a brand new ballpark down there and an expansion team. And best of luck getting it done. Thanks again.
Thanks, Dave.
I appreciate
David,
it.
Thank you again.
Thank you
very much.
Thanks for having me. Good talking to you guys. Have a great day.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
One of our listeners, regular listeners, Paul Caron, said an interesting question into me for Dave, which we didn't have time to get to. He was in a time deadline right there. I don't know if he would have given us a great answer about it, but the question was, does he regret bringing in his fellow Ivy League native, Brad Ausmus, without experience when he had a shot to get Terry Francona?
Yeah, that'd be interesting.
I don't think he would say yes to that. He might hem and haw, but I don't think he's that kind of a guy unless it's private. By the way, three or four of those guys he mentioned besides Mike Beck, Roland Heeman, believe it or not, was in the party that signed me in 1959. No, 1962.
Mike
and Bill Veeck and of course Paul Richards. I got to meet all those guys early in my career. They were all very impressive guys, and they came to the ballpark every day in a shirt and tie. That's how much it dramatically changed since then.
I wanted to ask him how we got the job at age 21. I mean, what would you and I have done, Bob, with a chance to work for a major league team at age 21? We'd have killed for it.
But I wanted to be a sports broadcaster. That's all I ever wanted to be. And I bet you he got that job the way you and I got our jobs. We met people. We were importunate. We reintroduced ourselves to people all the time. You hustle, 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 and maybe you get a break. And I bet that's what happened to Dave.
Anyway, thank you for joining us today. I will not be here on Thursday, but Bob and Denny will carry on.
We are going to. Okay, whatever. I never know. All
right. It's up to you guys. But
We were trying to get a hold of you a little while ago. You were deep in thought doing
something. Well, I'm frequently deep in thought, Denny. I'm an intellectual, you know.
In any case, have a great day, everybody, and they'll see you again on Thursday.
Thanks, everybody. See you soon. Stay safe, guys.